This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Bookmark. I am Uma Pagan. I'm PK Pagan. The only thing on everyone's mind over the last 10, 12 days has been the disappearance of MH Flight 370. Interestingly enough, there has been a lot of criticism as to how badly our authorities have communicated the issue. I, for one, believe that the media has just been just as bad at communicating to us, especially in the early days of the disappearance when there were lots of technical terms and lots of things thrown about with very little explanation on the part of the media. So today on Bookmark, we've taken it upon ourselves here at BFM to suggest some further reading, if you will, to help you understand the situation with MH370. And to do that, to help me do that, I am joined by our intrepid reporter, Amirul Ruslan, who has been on the scene at KLIA for the last, well, however many days. And he's been doing a lot of reading himself and become pretty much an aviation enthusiast over the last 2 weeks. Hi, Amirul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Uma. Thanks for having me on board.
So I was looking through my list, and I, like you, have been doing quite a lot of reading over the last couple of weeks. And it's interesting. I've kind of made a selection of four books that have to do with systems. And I think everything about air investigations and disappearances always boil down to a failure of systems. You've got something. You've got a little bit more personal angles, don't you? You've got a lovely little story with Jim Thompson.
Yes, that's right. Which I'm sure we'll get into at some point. But yeah, air disasters, particularly MH370, have a mystery angle. You know, it's a whodunit. You know, it's a classic mystery. Everyone wants to solve it. It might be something as simple as a short circuit on board. It could be something considerably more complex, you know, with evil human intentions.
Something sinister, yeah.
Yeah, you know, many of us are you know, self-proclaimed aviation experts, and just as many are positing conspiracy theories.
Yes, and by day five or six, the crazies start coming out.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You know, there are all sorts of theories that range from political to technical to paranormal. And this is interesting because what we've got essentially is a fiction thriller scenario unfolding in real life.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It is the stuff. It feels like an Agatha Christie locked room mystery, which essentially adds to our fascination of it, because everything happens in this tube, this metal tube, that is that has human beings completely disconnected from the rest of the world, from community, from society.
Yep.
And when something goes wrong, any possible clue is on that tube.
Absolutely. That's why we focused, the investigation media coverage has focused so much on passengers with possible engineering knowledge, passengers who may have been pilots, the pilots itself. I mean, after all, flying, you know, the aforementioned metal tube is not an easy task whatsoever. It's it requires years and years of experience on top of that know-how. So it's just finding out these personalities who are behind the plane has already made for really riveting reading.
So, you know, which brings me to my first book. And actually, I spoke to Bill Adair, who wrote this book yesterday on the evening edition. It's called The Mystery of Flight 427, Inside a Crash Investigation. What's interesting about this book? So, US Air Flight 427 was one of the most, I guess, baffling mysteries faced by the National Transportation Security Board, NTSB, Safety Board, sorry, NTSB, back in the 90s. It took them 5 years to solve this mystery, if you will. A plane had crashed into a hill in Pittsburgh. Everything was going fine. And then something went wrong, and in 28 seconds, everyone was dead. And they didn't know what it was, and they couldn't figure it out, because a plane is millions of parts.
Of course.
Made by hundreds of different manufacturers. And so what happened was, and why this book is fascinating is because even, you know, we don't even know if MH370 has crashed. We don't know where the plane is. But whatever the case, I think what's interesting about this book is it goes into great detail as to just what entails an investigation, what you need. I mean, it's phenomenal. They have experts studying the grunts of pilots. These people, all they do is listen to audio recordings of the way the pilots say specific words, how many times they've repeated those same words, whether it's a curse word, and what is the frequency of their voice, mm-hmm. And by that you can judge, you can gauge stress level, and then you can gauge whether it was pilot error. Because obviously if someone was in... And even grunts, even noises. They have a woman who's 80 years old and works for the Smithsonian, who's a feather expert. She's the world's most renowned feather expert. And all she does is study feathers to look for traces of possible bird collisions.
That's incredible.
Right?
And so much goes into an investigation like this. I mean, to a journalist like myself, you can tell where the interest is, because there's so much to study, there's so much to learn about, and there's so much to uncover. Even something as simple as, as you mentioned, grunts that could uncover potentially a lot of information that could serve into providing a profile on what a pilot is like when he's flying the plane.
Exactly. And, and from those grunts as well, you can tell whether an individual is under a stressful situation, mm-hmm. perfectly calm, or even under duress by someone else in the cockpit. And based on previous flight audio recordings as to how they respond to certain things.
Yep.
So that, the mystery of Flight 427 inside a crash investigation goes through all of this. I mean, Bill Adair himself was only one of two journalists to get that level of access to the NTSB. The other one was a New Yorker journalist. And It really unfolds like a mystery novel, because you don't know. In the end, it turned out to be a rudder problem.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, to get to that point took them 5 years and hundreds of tests. They would hire a 727 and a 737 to recreate the exact conditions in which there was wake before the plane went down.
Mm-hmm.
They would spend hundreds of hours in NASA flight simulators, recreating exactly what happened. It's phenomenal. So, yeah, it's definitely... You can get the book on Amazon.com. I haven't been able to find it in KL, mm-hmm. but Bill Adair, The Mystery of Flight 427. What have you been reading, Amaral?
Well, I've been reading not specifically about aircraft disasters, but I have been reading about all the things that growing up inspired me about aviation, aeronautics. One of my favorite authors growing up was Roald Dahl, and he himself was a pilot. He served in the British Air Force during World War II, and the RAF, of course, had a fantastic campaign. And some of his more interesting stories revolved around World War II and around how flying seemed like such a simple concept. We all know this from how we understand it, is that it's one of the most freeing things you could ever do. Man no longer limited by gravity, but at the same time, there's a lot that comes into it. There's disaster is just one mistake away, and the more I reread this, the more I realize that disaster being a mistake away could be a fairly mundane explanation for what happened to MH370. It could be a mundane explanation for so many future air disasters as well.
Yeah, because there's one thing important to note, which is Roald Dahl going solo, I guess. But there's one thing important to note is that every airline incident is never due to one thing.
It's
always a sequence of events, which is both mechanical and human in nature, and how they work together to actually cause a major incident. Important to note, there were almost 3 billion passengers on 37.5 million flights in mm-hmm. 2012. And those were all safe,
perfectly
and
normal,
without incident, because flying remains one of the most highly regulated, and with the way technology is going, one of the safest ways to travel.
And every country in the world cares about having their passengers reach a destination safely.
Absolutely, right? There's another book which I'm reading, which is quite interesting, by a guy called Charles Perrow, or Perrow, mm-hmm. P-E-R-R-O-W, and it's called Normal Accidents, Living with High-Risk Technologies. When there is an inherent risk of using a technology, we basically try to build systems that take into account the possible points of failures. And I think that's something very apparent in automobiles, in aircraft, in boats, in computers, in phones, in anything we use, right? However, the more single-point failures we try to build into something, or we try to prevent through system design, however clever it may be, just makes the system more and more complex.
Complex, of course, yeah.
And so there is this question of whether or not it is possible to actually have a system that's completely risk-free and whether we can be 100% safe at any one time. And that's what this book is about. Because when we fly, you don't think of the inherent dangers of flying.
Absolutely not. I mean,
and rightly so.
Yeah. It's this is, lots of people are scared of flying, but it's not because it's inherently unsafe. In fact, more work has gone into making flying safe than, I'm sure, many mundane things. Everyone talks about how statistically, you know, you're 6,000 times more likely to get hit, you know, walking on your way home, stuff like that. It's also worth noting that not only is it so safe, I've actually done some reading and I've discovered that, Wikipedia has a list of aircraft accidents or incidences in fiction. And the Boeing 777 that MH370 operated on is, of course, known to all as a being as being a particularly safe aircraft.
There have only been three hull loss incidents.
Yes, that's like all related to pilot error and pilot suicide, in fact. And in fact, it's not an idea that we can easily comprehend that it could happen. In fact, even in fiction, this Wikipedia list lists a whole number of incidences that happens in movies and books. I could only find a single reference to a single event happening to a 777, and that was Oceanic Flight 815 in Lost.
In Lost. So basically, even fiction writers are like, oh, wait a minute, that's a really safe plane. It's unbelievable.
It can't happen to a 777, can it?
that's a good find, Amirul. That's a great find. I mean, that's interesting because, you know, in fiction as well, whether it's in Fringe, in The X-Files, Stephen King novels, airliner mysteries are known to make us feel insecure.
Yes.
And for that same reason we mentioned earlier, the locked door mystery idea, the same thing that people felt on boats, on ships 100 years ago, right? You're out in the middle of the ocean, you're disconnected from society. If something goes wrong, it's truly frightening, and it's truly a mystery.
Absolutely. I mean, and no one likes feeling like they could, like their fate might not be known to anyone else.
Yeah. We are talking about some possible reads that will help you better understand the disappearance behind MH370. I've got Amirul Ruslan, who is part of our BFM news team, who's been at KLIA since the mystery started unfolding. When we return, we will be talking about hijacking and also a book by Michael Crichton. Don't go anywhere. This is Bookmark on BFM 89.9.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Bookmark on The Bigger Picture. I'm Uma Pagan, I'm PK Pagan, and I'm joined today by Amirul Ruslan, member of our BFM news team, because we're giving you some possible reads to help you better understand the mystery, the disappearance, and all the complicated technical aspects of MH370 and Boeing 777s and everything that goes into an investigation that happens after an incident like this. So, we talked about Mystery of Flight 427 by Bill Adair, Normal Accidents, which is a book, Living with High-Risk Technologies by Charles Perrow. What's interesting about that book, Amirul, is that what we call human error, what we call is often a mixture of simple mistakes, right? And and the confusion that's inherent with working with complex systems, like, you know, piloting a few hundred ton airplane, right?
Of course, yeah.
There's this idea of incomprehensibility. That's what Perrow calls in his book. And basically, how it stems is that people involved in an accident or any accident can't figure out fast enough what is happening. That's because in high-stress situations, your brain reverts to well-trod models that help you understand your world. So you think about the stuff you've practiced 1,000 times, that you've done 100 times. You think about what you've been told will happen if X happens.
Yes.
But of course, in every situation, whether it was the Air France situation, whether it was the Flight 427, USF Flight 427, what's going on doesn't actually match training. The brain needs to find a way to make it mesh. And so these rational explanations that might make sense to you at that moment somehow lead you to make mistakes that exacerbate a problem that's already going on. That's a frightening thought.
That's actually a frightening thought. I mean, we, especially with air flight in particular, everyone knows the safety procedures. It's something that you're drilled into every time you fly. Most of us have flown multiple times.
Even if you're not paying attention, you know, subliminally, you're receiving that in your subconscious, right?
You know it's going to... if it happens, this is what you do. You know how to bend and hold on to the seat. You know where the exits are. But precious few people, for good reason, actually have to go through that. But at the same time, when you do go through that, you know, panic sets in. You can't account for panic. You can't account for how someone behaves under immense stress. And that's, as you've mentioned, that's what happens when that creates a series of mistakes.
Right. So tell us about Jim Thompson.
So, okay, one of my favorite books of all is Jim Thompson, The Unsolved Mystery by William Warren. It's essentially a book that documents the entire missing persons case of Jim Thompson plus what happened. So Jim Thompson was this American businessman who founded the modern Thai silk industry.
Right. And he was based in Cameron Highlands?
He was based in Bangkok.
Bangkok.
But one day he took a holiday to the Cameron Highlands and he went for a walk and he just never appeared again. This is very important because up until today, it was the biggest manhunt, the biggest missing persons case in Malaysian history. It involved international cooperation. It involved police. In fact, there were even mystics and psychics and bomos involved, all with their various different...
Even back then.
Especially back then, one could say. And to this day, 47 years on, we've not found the answer to that. We don't know what happened to Jim Thompson. There's not even a single shred of conclusive evidence to prove it. And the more I cover MH370, I'm reminded of that because to this day, a week on, despite you know the world's best minds, the world's best agencies, the FAA, the NTSB, the French civil aviation authorities as well, we haven't found a single thing. We haven't found debris. You know, everyone spots what could be a door that turns out to be logs, you know, attached together. So the Jim Thompson book is especially interesting because it also was a mystery that created a number of conspiracy theories. For example, one thing that upon investigation, investigators found was that Thompson himself was a former agent of the CIA, or more accurately, the OSS.
So I heard about that. Was that something proven?
Yes. There are service records of him training in World War II to be deployed in Bangkok as an agent of America to help with the transition from the Japanese Japanese collaborationist government to a modern democratic government. He was supposed to go, but it didn't happen. By the time he was trained, the war was already won, so there was no need. But he went to Thailand anyway. He had all those contacts. This was, of course, the great Bangkok of 1940s, where it was the mysterious Orient, and that's where he set himself up. And as a result, because he's such an interesting personality, because he was a man who single-handedly invented the Thai silk industry, many people today, which, I mean, it's assumed that silk in Thailand is just part of the culture.
Yeah.
But before, you know, the middle and late 1940s, it didn't actually exist as anything more than just a cottage industry. So Jim Thompson was the man who effectively created this exotic business career a world away from his home in the in the Midwest, and then one day he just disappears and no one finds him and people are guessing, oh, it's the communists, because this disappearance happened in 1967.
Of course it was the communists.
And then people are like, no, the CIA extracted him because his mission was complete. Some people said that he actually fell in love with an Orang Asli tribe in Central Pahang and he's never wanted to leave,
and he's still there
and he's still there somewhere.
So it's an incredible story, and you're absolutely right with these sorts of mysteries. I mean, there are some mysteries that remain unsolved to this day. Amelia Earhart, for example.
Of course, yeah.
It's the other interesting point about that book, and I guess the reaction of the public to that book, is the celebrity of Jim Thompson.
Yes.
Because the very first, I mean, so American commercial, I guess, aviation has been around, you know, since the Wright brothers.
That's right.
And the 20s and the 30s, there was a massive... There were lots of planes, and you know, there were their fair share of crashes as well. However, the very first big crash and investigation involved a celebrity. It was an American football coach.
That's right.
And it was celebrity that kind of pushed Congress into setting up the equivalent of an NTSB. The NTSB came into being in around the 60s, but there were lots of other agencies that used to do these things. But it was media attention. It was the people, the need of the people to know what happened, why did it crash, that set up the government, that set the government in action to actually find, to set up this massive, I guess, processes and systems to that they now do so well. To investigate what happens after a crash. If government spent as much time and money improving automobiles and highway safety, we would, you know...
Autopilot cars.
We'd be autopilot cars, right? We'd be living in a very, very safe world. And so it's interesting how much celebrity plays a role in having these things remain in our, I guess, collective consciousnesses, right? There's another book called Airframe by Michael Crichton. It's a piece of fiction.
Okay.
What's fascinating about Michael Crichton is if you read anything about Michael, anything by Michael Crichton, he wrote Jurassic Park, Andromeda Strain, Disclosure. All of his books are about failing systems.
That's right.
That's his big thing.
Yeah.
Jurassic
Park. That's a common theme.
Exactly. Human body, Andromeda Strain, dinosaur theme park, mm-hmm. Jurassic Park, internal politics of office and sexual abuse, Disclosure. Yep. And the Airframe is the ultimate, an airplane is the ultimate system. It is hundreds of thousands of systems created
with
man.
Redundancies and backups.
Exactly.
It's made not to fail.
And so the investigation of such a system makes for very compelling fiction. In this case, the plane doesn't crash. It's a plane, Flight 545, that is badly shaken in an incident. But what happens is three people die, but nobody really knows why. Whether pilot error, is it a design fault in the aircraft? There's lots of things. Act of God, nobody knows. And what is fascinating about Michael Crichton, or why I recommend him, is because he's incredibly meticulous. If you read Jurassic Park and then watch the film, the film is an adventure movie. The book feels like a scientific textbook in most times, right? We're talking about chaos theory and all of this stuff about how systems fail. This is the same. When he dedicates his writing towards... the writing can be a bit dry, mind you, but when he dedicates his writing towards an aircraft investigation, what it means is he's spending all of this time giving you, I would say, some of the most realistic accounts of aircraft investigation that you can find in fiction.
Yeah.
So Airframe is a very, very good book because it doesn't glorify a disaster or a tragedy, and that's what I enjoy. It goes into the real technical and scientific detail of an aircraft investigation, which is very, very cool.
That's cool. Actually, I'm going to have to pick that up because that's going to make wonderful reading in between new snippets on what happened to this current plane.
So there's something else you've done which I would like to recommend people to read, is that you set up a blog immediately after the plane went missing as a kind of myth-busting explainer blog, if you will.
That's right. What happened was, in the immediate aftermath of the flight's disappearance, I found that one of the biggest problems was the fact that no one could actually tell what was fact and what was fiction. There was so much miscommunication, misinformation, and it was just a mess that I found that it my job as a journalist there at the scene wasn't so much pushing stories or publishing anything as it was firefighting. I needed to make sure that everyone, you know, not just at work, but also the wider public, knew that this is what we know, and this is a guess. Many people have taken guesses to fairly ridiculous extremes. What happened was, on Twitter, I received a fair bit of interest from people who were just looking for concise and clear information, and one person in particular, one user contacted me and said that complimented me over the tweets I've been making, and she suggested that I set up a blog, that we set up a blog. And it was an idea that I had independently as well. I would do it like as a part-time thing. And then I realized, given the gravity of the situation, it just became much larger and larger. And so the co-editor, Tiara, and myself, we now have whereismh370.com. It's a blog that essentially answers reader questions, rebuts speculation, as well as tries to make a clearer understanding of what happens. Because what I'm seeing now is that this is probably, 9/11 happened 13 years ago. That was a time when internet journalism had not entered social media journalism.
You're right.
It's not something where you're summing it down to 140 characters and then publishing a tweet. It's not about... It's constant updating, live blogs, live streams. We no longer have separate articles for everything, which was confusing because sometimes you'd have an updated headline that would reflect an old article with two new paragraphs right in the bottom.
Correct. And of course, most people don't even read the article. They actually read the tweet.
Absolutely. So what happened with where is MH370.com is that we wanted the fundamentals. We wanted the information, the raw data. We wanted transcripts. We wanted translations. We wanted to double confirm if this was someone said, something said by some that one particular someone. We didn't like how misattribution to this day is something that even the likes of CNN keeps doing, you know. A statement that comes from the acting minister of transport and a statement that comes from the Malaysia Airlines CEO are two different things. And
representing two different
organizations with skill sets and knowledge that should be kept distinct.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right. I think it's a great job because, like you said, 5% has been probably fact and 95% speculation as to what we've been seeing over the last few weeks. What's also interesting in this kind of myth-busting exercise, of course, is that I find that media the world over, it's come to light in this event, cannot tell the difference between cannot confirm and deny.
Absolutely.
There is absolutely no distinction between those two terms.
As recently as yesterday when I was last at the airport, we had stories made out of pure desperation simply because, okay, there was a question posed that received, you know, a politician's answer and you kind of are trying to digest that into a story. And you can't really do that because we're investigating further, you know, as an answer can't be translated into yes or no. And you can't position fact based on a maybe answer or we can't talk now answer. So what's happened is we are seeing conjecture, as I've mentioned before, taken to an extreme.
And being passed off as reports.
Being passed off as reports. As editor of Where is MH370, we've received a number of questions, and this is a wonderful way to gauge how the average public man on the street is thinking, because they're asking questions about, hey, can you prove that people did call passengers on the plane? Like, whoa, you shouldn't take this as fact. We've not established that this happened. In fact, the investigation is still ongoing. The authorities have said as much, but you're assuming that people have made calls. And there's only so far you can go with that theory because proving something is something that requires the resources of an investigator, and as well equipped as some of the media organizations out there are, they can't actually shadow or be at this over the shoulder looking over each investigator.
Exactly. You are relying on what information is being transferred to you.
Absolutely.
So check out where is MH370.com as well for some myth busting as to what's being reported in the media. The one last book which I would like to recommend is a book by Brendan I. Corner called The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. No one's actually mentioned the H word. Yet. It's a very emotive word.
It's an emotive word and no one wants to address that possibility just yet.
And whatever that comes from it, right? The fundamentals that come from it. But what's interesting about this book is he chronicles, Brendan Kohner chronicles an extended moment from 1968 to 1972 where dozens of planes in the United States were taken over by hijackers. Mm-hmm. Now, the first hijacking in U.S. airspace kind of occurred in the spring of 1961 when a Miami electrician pressed a steak knife to the throat of a National Airlines pilot and declared, "If I don't see Havana in 30 minutes, we all die." Now, the incident kind of kicked off this phenomenon that gathered momentum for the next 11 years when 159 commercial flights were commandeered, sometimes at a rate of one per week or even two in a single day.
Now, that's something we don't expect now. We're living the post-9/11 era where a hijacking is a really big deal.
Exactly. Meanwhile, in the 70s and the 60s, by 1972, there were 40 hijackings a year. Wow. And the phrase "take me to Havana" had become a punchline in American sitcoms. You know, I think it was even all, Archie Bunker and All in the Family proposed a plan in which the airlines might provide passengers with the means to fight back, just pass out pistols at the beginning of the flight, you know, uproarious laughter and so on and so forth. But Kona kind of draws on these incidents and talks about the vast and varied motives that people have for hijacking, from starstruck lovers to political to madmen to political refugees.
I mean, everyone's got an agenda.
Everyone's got an agenda, and some actually don't.
Yeah.
At all, right? And I think that's what's interesting, because a lot of us are kind of trapped in the current interpretation of hijacking, where we think it's due to religious extremist behavior.
Yeah.
Or seeking asylum or something like that. They're very narrow, that if you haven't made a demand, then it can't possibly be a hijacking. But that's never been the case.
Yeah.
Exactly. So Brendan I. Kona, The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. You can check out that book as well. I have a conversation with Brendan Kona. That'll be on tomorrow's evening edition. You can tune in to that to find out a kind of a contextual history of hijackings as we know it until the present day. Amirul, thank you so much for joining me on Bookmark.
Thank you, Uma.
You know, Amirul has a story about the ghost of Jim Thompson. Why don't you tell us that really quickly before we go?
Okay, so a few years back, I was a lifestyle journalist, and one of the things we had to do was do a model shoot in Cameron Highlands. It was beautiful. It was December. It was really cool. It was me, the photographer, and a male actor. So we were doing shoots all day from 6 a.m. all the way to, I think we stopped around 4 a.m. or so. But around midnight, and we were in a certain hotel we shall stay unnamed. We were in a hotel that had a lot of history, and much like many places in Cameron Highlands, was really imbued with the Jim Thompson myth. So my job was to set up particular scenes to do shoots and set up lighting and all that. So this hotel had two restaurants actually. One was the usual breakfast place, and one was over the top for like a fine dining English experience. So I thought, okay, you know, Cameron Highlands, let's do it upstairs. I set up the lights, and this particular building was on a slope. So I started feeling really uneasy, maybe because it was just me late at night. But then I felt something was odd, because it was focused purely on the window. And I felt like there was someone there watching me on the window. But I knew well that there was no windowsill, and it was on a slope, a flat slope. So there could have been nothing there. The next day, I went to Google Maps and discovered that the orientation of that window pointed straight towards Moonlight Cottage, the cottage in which Jim Thompson disappeared. We visited that particular cottage, and it was just dread and creepiness for me. And for about 6 months, I felt like there was this weird presence with me. And I'm not a supernatural guy at all. And it only disappeared when I made a visit to Bangkok. And I was like, hey, Bangkok, might as well go to the Jim Thompson house. So I went there, and suddenly like this incredible sense of relief, like oh, okay, no more baggage. So part of me, you know, the more paranormally inclined part,
feels responsible for taking Jim Thompson home.
Yeah.
Well done, Amirul Ruslan. That's a fantastic note to end on. You've been listening to Bookmark on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.